Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamara-Sami, and as we approach the anniversary, first anniversary of the October the 7th attacks, when armed fighters from Hamas and other militant groups attacked southern Israel, killing at least 1,200 people and taking more than 250 others hostage, we will be revisiting Kibbutz Be'eri that was attacked that day. We'll speak to a British Israeli woman whose father is still being held in Gaza. We'll also be hearing from a Palestinian teenager about her experience of a year living in a war zone. We begin, though, today in Lebanon, where the war between Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah is intensifying and widening. We can speak to the BBC's Lina Sinjab, who's in the capital, Beirut. Lina, perhaps you can start with the situation in Beirut itself. What has been happening overnight? What is the situation like today?
Well, it is a repeated situation almost every single day, with overnight, you know, airstrikes on the southern suburb of Beirut in Dahiya, that is keeping the whole city, you know, sleepless. Tonight, the attacks, we haven't heard from the Israelis who they are targeting, but smokes of dust is still seen in the air, even seen from close to the airport area. Something that is worrying, that the expansionist attacks of Israel could, you know, enlarge further in the city. And we've seen also that these attacks are not restricted to certain areas, because today there was another airstrike in Tripoli, the city northern of Lebanon, and the attack was targeting a Hamas leader who was the head of the armed brigade of the Hamas group. He was assassinated with his wife and two children. In the south of Lebanon, the situation is as worse, you know, further attacks now attacking even hospitals and paramedics and the mosque. The Israelis say that the Hezbollah are operating inside the mosque and inside, you know, ambulances, trying to move fighters and armed groups. But the paramedics are really concerned, because over 37 hospitals that now are not operating, fearing for the attacks, and some 9 paramedics have been injured so far.
Any update on whether or not an earlier attack in Beirut targeted the man presumed to have taken over as the leader of Hezbollah?
Well, that's what everyone was talking about in media and social media yesterday, as the yesterday's overnight attacks targeted Hisham Safiuddin, who was, said to be taking over from late leader Hassan Nasrallah. But that hasn't been confirmed neither by the Israelis nor by Hezbollah itself. And it hasn't been even confirmed whether he will be succeeding Hassan Nasrallah into power. But of course, the Israelis say that there are consecutive assassinations that they have conducted against Hezbollah. And, you know, hundreds of them have been killed in the past 2 weeks.
And what of firing the other way, Hezbollah rockets continuing to fire into Israel? What do we know?
Well, that's exactly the case. I mean, it hasn't stopped since, you know, the 8th of October last year. Hezbollah has engaged in cross-border firing. One would think that after all the blow they had to their power, to their security, to their top leader, that their strategy will change. But that hasn't changed. They're still firing rockets into Israel, and they're saying that they're battling with Israeli forces that are advancing on the ground. So far, we've heard that at least 8 Israeli soldiers have been killed in field battles. But the Israeli forces are still advancing and still sending warnings of evacuations to towns and villages in the south.
Lena, many thanks. The BBC's Lena Sinjab in Beirut. Well, Lebanese officials say the war has now displaced more than 1 million people, with many foreigners trying to leave the country. The UK, one of 23 countries that is trying to get its nationals out, has already organised 3 evacuation flights. Well, Nasreen is a Canadian-Lebanese woman from Calgary. She travelled to Lebanon last month to visit her Lebanese husband before the war began. We're not using her surname for her own safety. Well, she's applied for a spousal visa for him. She's been doing that for a year, but she hasn't got one yet. And I asked her about her plans.
I'm right now in West Bekaa. West Bekaa is like a nice place. You don't hear so much bomb, so much, but still you hear and you feel scared. Right now I plan to go back because my husband said it's not safe for me anymore to stay here. I tried myself to help him, to get him to fly with me back to Canada, but my embassy doesn't help me at all. My concern now, if the embassy can call, I know it's not too much time. It's two more days for me here and I have to fly back to Canada. If they can give him a visa, I'll deal with that. I'll deal with the ticket. I'll deal with everything. We don't need anything. Just we need that paper to let him. We have already application for him since November 2023.
And you're trying to get him a spousal visa?
Yes. I'm trying to get visa, like just regular visa for him just to fly there. We have already application number. We have everything. I know it's going to take a little bit of time, but I didn't know it's going to take a year.
This is clearly a very difficult time for you, Nasreen. You're determined, though, you are going to leave, even if you're unable to get a visa for your husband.
Yeah, that's no choice, because he said it's not safe anymore. There's no choice. We have to do it. I'd like to stay with him, but it's no choice for me anymore. Plus, my mom, my family there, they are coming crazy every day. All of them, they are in Calgary. I don't have anyone here except my 2 aunties here. And I didn't even go there and say hello to them, because even they're bombing somewhere in Bekaa. And if we need to go to Syria, that's a scary place. I cannot go there. No way.
Is it too dangerous to go physically to Beirut, to go to the embassy? Have you tried that?
I did that one last Friday. I went there. I told them I have already an appointment, but we canceled it because the war started, I think, Tuesday before. And I showed them. They said, oh, you have to contact. We cannot give you. You're not allowed to go in. And I'm just like, guys, I'm Canadian citizen. I have my passport. I need just to talk to someone.
Canada has said that if there is an evacuation, they will help Canadian citizens and their accompanying spouse. Is that what you understand?
I did call. I did send an email to them. They said, send the file and everything for us. I did send the file number and everything. Since that, I didn't hear anything. I sent another email. Hey, guys, please, I need an update. I'm going to book the ticket for him. We need just update, please. They didn't even answer. They send it in the morning. If you want to call to go to Turkey, we'll make a place for you for $450, but you have to pay from your pocket.
Just to be clear, could your husband get on that flight, though, to Turkey?
For my flight, no, he cannot, because he doesn't have a visa or anything. He has a passport, yes. We have a file number, yes, but I don't have a visa. Even Canada doesn't allow him to go in.
What's he going to do then if you're unable to get a visa before you leave?
It's no choice. I have to go back to Canada, talk to my lawyer, talk to the IRCC Canada, talk to MP, even the MP Parliament. I did talk to him last week and he said, go to the embassy, talk to them about the situation.
Is there anyone else that can help you?
No, actually, I'm really stuck. 2 more days, I'm going to fly. He's going to be here. I have to deal with that.
And about getting to the airport, are you worried about the security situation? Are you worried about the route you have to take?
Oh, yes. That's a part when we drive from that area where they are bombing. I'm going to put my hand on my heart. I'm not sure what's going on, what's waiting for us.
Nasreen, a Canadian-Lebanese woman who's trying to leave Lebanon, return to Calgary in Canada. And we have asked the Canadian Embassy for a response about this case, and we are still waiting to hear back from them. Well, for the point of view of the Lebanese government, I've been speaking to the country's economy minister, Amin Salam.
I'm in Beirut, central district, downtown Beirut. We are safe here, despite the fact that 2 nights ago, the explosion was less than 2 miles from where we are based and 2 miles from the parliament and the governmental palace. And that was the first close hit downtown inside the city of Beirut. And it really, really caused a lot of damage. It caused a lot of civilian casualties and was a very unfortunate escalation towards the city.
Have you been forced to change the way you work as a result of this?
Well, I'm working around the clock on emergency mode, so I cannot think of any other way that we'll be working through, like, as ministers. I mean, we have been going to our offices normally. We have been going to the governmental palace for emergency committee meetings. However, we're trying to be very careful moving around because at this point we cannot trust where the Israelis will hit. So that's a big security concern, but we're trying to go around it.
You're the economy minister. What are the main things that you are having to deal with at the moment?
So this escalation or this kind of, prolonging this escalation is weighing heavily, heavily on the economy that, as you know, is already in bad shape. I mean, Lebanon's economy turmoil has been almost 3 or 4 years old now. The government and the economy both are in a tough position. And that war has added yet another layer of challenge to the economy, bringing down the GDP, putting hundreds of thousands of the workforce out of employment, destroying all the farmlands, which is something that the economy relies a lot in Lebanon, the agricultural sector. 60% of it in the south and in the Beqa areas are completely, completely burnt and destroyed. Let alone, the tourism sector, which is usually a catalyst, a major sector in Lebanon.
Well, people are now focused on leaving the country rather than entering it, aren't they? What kind of challenges does that present?
Well, that's a major challenge. Now, most of the false citizens or Lebanese citizens with foreign nationalities have been departing Lebanon. Our airport is still open. Our national airlines is still functioning. And there's thousands leaving the country every day. But the biggest catastrophe is the 1 million displaced people around the city and around Mount Lebanon area that are, seeking shelter, seeking food, seeking health aid. You have hundreds of thousands of children that are in shelter homes or in schools or in hospitals.
And as you've indicated, this is coming off the back of several years of crisis for your country. What are you able to do to help those large numbers of people who are now displaced?
So we're working on two parallel tracks. One of them is the diplomatic work that we're doing along with a number of the Arab countries, the United States and Europe on an immediate ceasefire. We're pushing for an immediate ceasefire to put an end to this because that's the only way to kind of stop the tragedy. The other track that we're doing is running the emergency committee's work, basically getting donations, getting aid from foreign countries, getting support from the United Nations and many other entities to be able to cater to the needs of those people. So it's a mix of major, probably the largest emergency operation for a country like the size of Lebanon in the world. And then the diplomatic work is going in parallel to all that, trying to get to a ceasefire.
That's Lebanon's economy minister, Amin Salam. And we will be hearing a bit more from him in just a moment here on NewsHour. Later on in the programme, we'll hear from Sharon, the daughter of 84-year-old Oded Lifshitz, who's one of the hostages who are still believed to be held in Gaza.
I know that on the first day, my father was doing everything he could to find my mother. I hope very much he knows that my mother is with us now. And if he can affect the situation, he would. He would try to make it better for the people around him as well, to other hostages.
The headlines at this hour: Israel has been continuing its offensive in southern Lebanon, with Hezbollah reporting fierce clashes. Doctors in the Democratic Republic of Congo are beginning a vaccination campaign to try to halt the spread of the Mpox virus. And the party of the jailed former Prime Minister of Pakistan says a close aide to Imran Khan has been arrested on a second day of mass demonstrations. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. And let's return now to our interview with Lebanon's economy minister Amin Salam, who is in Beirut. Hezbollah has said its fighters have been engaged in fierce clashes with Israeli troops in the southern border zone. So what's the status of the Lebanese army at the moment in that war between Israel and Hezbollah?
Well, so far, I mean, I wouldn't really categorize this war against Hezbollah. As Minister of Economy, I can tell you this war is against Lebanon. I mean, it's very clear that everything that is being hit brings the country down. And we're talking about 2,000 civilians being killed so far. So that's that. But then on the other hand, the Lebanese army, yes, the Lebanese army is trying to be on the more on the peaceful side of the negotiations, not intervening, so we don't turn it into a wider war, which would be catastrophic, you know, particularly on Lebanon.
But what can the government do to influence things at the moment?
Well, the government is pushing on all fronts, including the Hezbollah front, to get to a ceasefire. And so far, even from the Hezbollah front, the government has received very, very positive, reassuring messages that they are willing to negotiate an immediate ceasefire, but at the same time, the Israelis are not leaving any space or any hope. Even after the government's official statement by the prime minister 2 days ago that we are willing to negotiate a ceasefire, and he made it very clear, he communicated that that was in discussions with Hezbollah, but the Israelis did not stop bombing. Actually, they escalated the bombing and hit new cities within the north today.
You'll know Israel says, look, if Hezbollah stops bombing cities in northern Israel, allows the 60,000 or so Israelis who've been forced to leave their homes to come back, that would be the end of it. They say that is the goal of this operation. So it would be, in one sense, easy to stop this if Hezbollah just stopped what they were doing, wouldn't it?
No, it's easier said than done, because the Israelis have lied on every corner. They have lied to us several times. They are destroying an entire country, while Hezbollah is what? Shelling like few rockets here and there. So the Israelis need to really, really think that through and help make the ceasefire happen. I mean, especially that our government made an official statement that we want the ceasefire and we're open to discussions.
So are you,
we get fired at.
Well, are you in direct contact with the Israeli government, or are you just issuing statements and hoping that they will pick up on them?
No. We are in direct contact with the United States, diplomatic channels with the Europeans, with the French on a daily basis. You know, we have direct communication. They are mediating all this issue. And they are communicating immediately to the Israeli side. It's not statements in the news. It's diplomatic channels working around the clock.
But via the Americans, so not directly.
No, not directly. Absolutely. It was never directly.
But even now that this full-scale war is happening, is there a way other than via the Americans to try and influence things?
There is no other way doing it without the Americans, because the Americans are going to be the ones that will solve it. Us doing it on our own or looking for another mediator will not help the ceasefire. The Americans will be the ones that will make it happen.
Do you have any cause for optimism at the moment?
Not on the short term, but I would say probably by the end of this year, after the U.S. elections, I think if people are doing some political reading, I think after the U.S. elections, no U.S. president wants to walk into the White House with landmines in the Middle East.
That was Lebanon's economy minister Amin Salam, and later on we will be considering the accusations by some that Israel's actions at the moment are in some way designed to have influence on that US election. Now, in 2003, a group of deaf friends from London launched Deaf Rave, inclusive parties that blend visuals and deep bass sounds to make beats felt and not just heard. 2 decades later, they became the first deaf DJ collective to perform at the UK's Glastonbury Music Festival. And this weekend, Deaf Rave is hosting its own all-day festival in London. It features sign language performances and vibration vests. That's a new way of improving the physical connection to music. And the BBC's Maria Clara Montoya has been finding out more.
Check one, check two. It's down to the DJ, Chinaman. And we are right here, live at South Bank.
How do deaf people listen to music? This is what I am here to find out. I'm with Troy Lee, DJ Chinaman, but I would like you to introduce yourself first.
I am the founder of Deaf Wave. We started it back in 2003. Back then, there wasn't really much social events for the deaf community, and I had to think of a solution. I thought, yeah, why not if we just set up one massive party for our community? There's all different ways of deaf people express themselves when it comes to music. Some of them wear hearing aids, some of them don't wear hearing aids. They just feel the vibrations. And what's so unique about the deaf community when they party is that no matter how loud the music is playing, we deaf people can communicate across the dance floor in sign language. Tonight, my role is to provide vibration backpacks or vests, and it's for the public, for them to feel the vibrations when we have the Deaf Wave DJs are playing.
And just to hear the first performance of the night, it's an MC, he's deaf, and apart from rapping, he's doing it in British Sign Language.
We're just going to do a quick, simple performance by MC Geezer.
I'm MC Geezer, I'm a deaf MC Sign Language rapper, and I'm Troy Lee, Chinaman, right-hand man for 20 years. When I first met Troy, I was only 17 and a half years old, so I wasn't even legal to go to the rave. When I'm on stage, it's a different story. I hype up the crowd. I make sure that I interact with the crowd. I get them to be part of the song. Because the song I write is all positivity. It's about unity, being in the community, all together as one.
I'm outside South Bank Centre. I've been enjoying a bit of Deaf Rave, and I'm here with two people that want to tell me about their experiences. Can you please introduce yourselves?
So my name is Raji. I'm deaf and blind. My name's Sally and I'm Raji's PA guy. I can feel the noise more than hear it because it's quite noisy. We've had the jackets on and it's so interesting. The vibrations are just brilliant. I'm trying to match the vibrations to the dance.
My name is Brian Trimmings. I went deaf to meningitis at age 18. I'm now 27. Before, I used to like feel like I couldn't hear music. Not the way that I used to be able to anyway, before I went deaf. And now, like, wearing the vest brings back that whole feeling that I had before I went deaf. And I feel like it is a really powerful experience.
It is not only deaf people on the dance floor. I've also seen people in wheelchairs, blind people, and all in all, it's been an experience of community and people coming together.
That was Maria Clara Montoya reporting from a deaf rave party at London's South Bank Arts Centre. And just a reminder, if you miss any live editions of the programme, you can always catch up with our podcast. We update it twice a day, 7 days a week. Just look for BBC NewsHour podcast in your search engine. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. In a moment, we'll be returning to our coverage of the war in the Middle East and looking back at the events that precipitated what's happened. We'll be hearing from a kibbutz that was attacked on October the 7th last year, and we'll speak to the daughter of one of the hostages abducted that day. First, though, many people would say food is an art form. But what about plastic models of food? Well, if you visit Japan, you will have seen restaurant windows filled with replicas of the dishes that are on offer on the menu. These models have been enticing potential customers to sample the real thing for almost 100 years. Well, now their creative strengths are being celebrated at an exhibition at Japan House here in London. And our reporter Will Leonardo went along.
Or tasting with your eyes.
Simon Wright, the director of programming at Japan House London, is talking us through what's believed to be the first exhibition of its kind in Britain.
Tap into or trigger the memory of the food.
Anyone who's visited Japan will immediately know what food replicas are. Intricately detailed, life-size plastic models of dishes being served inside cafes or restaurants, often on display in glass cases. They're always hyper-real. At times, they're uncanny. And seeing as their main purpose is to draw you inside, this exhibition has our mouths watering. There are bowls of noodles so real-looking you can almost smell them, and sashimi with every groove and pattern of the raw fish perfectly recreated. Tell me, what did you make of the exhibition?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely was not planning on getting a matcha latte right now, but I'm afraid that I'll have to for the sake of the art.
Is it making you hungry?
A little bit, yes. I mean, yeah, okay, we all like a bit of sushi, but some of the dishes just like completely different, something I've never seen before. So, yeah, it really makes me want to go and see Japan.
All of it looks really, really real and really, really delicious. It's a good thing I'm going to go eat later.
As another exhibition visitor pointed out, it's amazing how something that started as a marketing device can, through decades of craftsmanship, be elevated into such an art form. Their story began in the 1920s, but they really took off properly a decade later, largely because of the efforts of one man, Takizō Iwazaki. The replica's heyday came in the post-war Showa era, with the proliferation of Western-style cafes serving lurid green melon sodas and fluffy pancakes, among other things. They soon spread to Western restaurants, Japanese eateries, and Chinese ramen joints. Plastic is often moulded around real food items, painted and then assembled as you would a real dish. It's an industry which requires precise and unique skills, and which still makes up the beating heart of Mr. Iwasaki's small hometown in the mountains, Gujō Hachiman. Simon Wright explains.
At the very heart of it, there is this memory of Iwasaki Takizō and how he really created a large business for the town and for Japan, really.
That was Simon Wright, the director of programming at Japan House, ending that report on the fake food exhibition there by the BBC's Will Leonardo. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. It has been almost a year since the Hamas attacks on Israel, and Israelis who live near Gaza are still dispersed and traumatised. Kibbutz Be'eri suffered more deaths than any other single community on October the 7th last year. 101 people there were killed. That's about 10% of its population, while 30 of its residents were taken hostage into Gaza. The BBC's Alice Cuddy has been back there to speak to some of the people that she met just after the attacks and who are still trying to come to terms with what happened.
They were on the roof, so they could see who's running in this direction, who's running in this direction, and they could shoot all over.
Ah, that's what he did.
Daphne Gessner returned to Be'eri with her best friend, Shea Guttentag.
So basically everything here was destroyed.
Yeah.
All the houses. All the almost houses every house is burned.
Maybe. Around 2 o'clock, all the terrorists from there saw there's a really...
killing zone here.
So they came and started shooting and killed everyone.
And these are like a memorial for the people.
Yeah, and all the broken pieces. This is part of the vehicle. It just melted.
She showed us the wreckage of her father's home, which was stormed by Hamas fighters on October 7th. I first met them just after the attacks. Daphne's father hid in the safe room for hours as the house burnt down around him. Her brother was one of those killed trying to defend the kibbutz.
The IDF did not
come here. It was only the people from the kibbutz, the fighter from the kibbutz.
They waited for the army, and they always had a feeling the army is near, the army is coming, they're going to save us, and they had like this hope. But actually, they had no chance.
They give one hell of a fight, no brother. They are heroes.
Yeah.
A crumpled graduation certificate, a charred board game. In the kitchen, there's a burned fridge freezer full of decayed food. That's the boom of bombs landing in Gaza, a reminder of the war that was started that day. You can still smell the burning here, can't you?
Yeah.
And it's been almost a year.
Yeah. You asked me before about the last year, how was it? It's between coping with the personal trauma and grieving for the dead people, and at the same time to fight for the hostages to come back, everything together. And I think people didn't got to really grieve for their loved one, because there are so many people just vanished.
After the 7th, this area was a military zone. You couldn't bury here, so buried elsewhere.
Rami Gold walks me through the graveyard after the funeral of the family killed on October 7th. Parents and their two children. This was just one of many.
Now, because October 7th is coming, they'd like to have them all back home so they can have the ceremonies here. So as far as the community is concerned, bring the deceased here to rebury them in Be'eri, it means they're coming home. And tomorrow there's another one. Next week, every other day, there's another one.
Does it still feel as raw as it did when you attended the funerals last October?
No, it isn't. It's although when you face it, it's just as hard. I bury them physically, and I still don't understand it. They're gone.
Rami is one of the few residents who moved back to Bury after the attacks to try to rebuild the community. For many, trauma means it's too soon to return. Hundreds of Bury's residents have moved to a temporary community about 40 minutes away. One of them is Shir. I met up with her again on the day she and her two daughters moved in.
So is this your first time seeing this?
Yeah.
Wow.
What do you think? Do you like it?
Yeah. She's excited. A new adventure, a new chapter. Yeah, it's about time.
Does it feel like you've kind of come a long way since then?
Yeah. They're happy and they feel safe.
Can you tell me a bit about what life has been like?
It's like a different life. Everything is different. Everything is needs adjustments. We're not at home. We're always fighting for the hostages to come. Everything is about the 7th. And we're trying to keep our heads up and live.
Shir Guten Tag, ending that report by Alice Cuddy. Well, 1,200 people were killed on October the 7th. Around 250 others taken hostage, among them the parents of Sharon Lifshitz, a British-Israeli academic. They were taken hostage from the Near Oz kibbutz. Her mother, Yocheved, was released after 2 weeks, but her 84-year-old father, Oded, is still in captivity. The family doesn't know whether or not he's alive. Sharon has been lobbying the Israeli and other governments to try and release her father and other hostages since then, and I've been speaking to her about her year. I began by asking her how her mother is now.
She's angry with the situation. She has 20 people of her community that are still alive, held hostage in Gaza. Having been in that situation, she cannot stop reliving it. Knowing what they are going through, only getting worse and worse to the initial conditions, which were extreme.
And what, if anything, have you heard of your father?
So we know my father was alive, that he arrived alive in Gaza on the 7th. He was injured. My mom thought he was dead. She saw him unconscious, but he regained consciousness and he was taken hostage to Gaza. One of the hostages that returned saw him on the first day injured, taken to be treated for his injury. Another hostage stayed with him in the room for the first 3 weeks or so. We have no knowledge of his whereabouts after that. We know he was in Khan Yunis. We know he was with Islamic Jihad.
He's someone who loves peace, speaks Arabic, I believe,
What has he been doing, do you think, to keep himself going during this year?
You know, my father, as you said, he knows the Gaza Strip very well, had many friends there before Hamas took over and instituted a totalitarian regime. If he's well enough, if he feels that his strength is with him, then he would be affecting the situation. I think both my parents are fearless in that way. I know that on the first day, my father was doing everything he could to find my mother. I hope very much he knows that my mother is with us now. And if he can affect the situation, he would. He would try to make it better for the people around him as well, to other hostages.
The idea of coexistence perhaps sort of been lost now, given what's happened over the past year. But I just wonder if you can tell our listeners, remind them of the place that you grew up in, what kibbutz and the values there.
So, first of all, you know, several days ago there was a terrorist shooting in Jaffa, which is a shared city, and people from the local mosque help people and the people of Israel, 20% of them are Palestinian with Israeli passport. These people, many of them, are integral part of the society. So the idea of coexistence is being alive every day in Israel in so many ways. I think that we see the result of not reaching long-term agreements, of working, Hamas educated a whole generation in the most horrific way, making it... We see the unfolding of two governments, the governments of Gaza and the government of Israel, that together did not want to reach the long-term agreement needed to make this a sustainable region. Are we further back? Yes, we are. But, my mom interviewed for the first time in a big interview yesterday in Israeli TV, and she said, this is our destiny. We'll have to find a way to live together.
Sharon Lifshitz, the daughter of one of the hostages still inside Gaza. Well, the war in the Middle East is widening just as Americans are preparing to vote in their presidential election. Some allies of President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are drawing a link between those two facts. Early this week, the Democratic Senator Chris Murphy said, I don't think you have to be a hopeless cynic to read some of Israel's actions as connected to the American election. Yesterday, President Biden was asked about that during his surprise appearance at a White House press briefing.
Do you have any worries that Netanyahu may be trying to influence the election and that's why he has not agreed to a diplomatic solution?
No administration has helped Israel more than I have. None. 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 And I think Bibi should remember that. And whether he's trying to influence the election or not, I don't know, but I'm not counting on that.
Well, Gina Yanitel Reinhardt is a professor of government at the University of Essex in the southeast of England. What does she make of those remarks?
I think that he is trying to deflect concern away from Kamala, if possible. And the most likely thing for American voters to do will be to blame Biden for not getting a ceasefire accomplished. And he's trying to say, well, it isn't entirely my fault, and therefore you shouldn't blame me and you shouldn't blame Kamala either.
It's one thing, though, to say it's not entirely my fault or indeed my vice president's fault. Another thing to suggest or not deny that you think that the Israeli prime minister is taking actions with an eye on the election. That's a different level, isn't it?
Sure, absolutely. But it's the same goal in the end. You know, he doesn't want to say, no, this has nothing to do with it, because that would mean that people will still see him as weak. And he's trying to say, these decisions are being made because they want to influence you and your choices, and you should be stronger and smarter than that, and don't let him make that decision for you. He's trying to make sure that the American people are not going to make their decisions based on this.
You don't see anything that could possibly then substantiate those allegations that there is something about the US election timetable that is playing into
Israel's calculations?
No, not at all. I think it is beneficial for Netanyahu to be doing this now, and because Netanyahu will be better off if Trump is president than if Kamala is. But I don't think that's driving his decision. His decision is based on his own election chances and his own desire to stay out of prison. He is very cognizant of what is going on over here. But it is just most likely that any influence he would be having right now on the elections in the U.S. is more like a bonus to him. But it's not the main reason for his decision.
He does, though, would you agree, have a better relationship with Donald Trump?
I think that if Trump is reelected, he is likely to do almost nothing with respect to Israel and Palestine, which is what Netanyahu wants. It would release and relieve some of the international pressure on him.
That was Gina Yanitel-Reinhart, who is Professor of Government at the University of Essex. And just a reminder, if you want to keep up to date with developments in the Middle East, we have a page on our website, bbc.com/news is what you need to look for. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. Earlier on in the programme, we heard from one of the kibbutzim that was attacked on October the 7th last year by Hamas. Well, Israel's military campaign in Gaza that began on the following day has also taken a huge toll. According to the Hamas-run health ministry, whose figures do not distinguish between Hamas fighters and civilians, nearly 42,000 people have been killed, with more than half of the buildings in the territory destroyed. And today, in the first warning of its kind for several weeks, Israel has called on Palestinians to evacuate parts of central Gaza, as the military said it was preparing to use what it called great force against Hamas fighters in the area. Over the past 12 months, the BBC's Christina Volk has been in almost daily contact with several young people across the Gaza Strip. One of them is a woman called Sanabel, and this is her story, told through the audio messages she has sent the BBC.
For me, the worst part of the war is when I hear these plans, I was crying sadly. I was also too fighting. Also, I hate these plans too much because they were the reason of killing my Angela and my uncles.
This is Sanabel. She's now 17. After the Israeli invasion into Gaza began in the wake of the October the 7th attacks, she and her family remained in Gaza City, in the north of the Strip. Although her home has been destroyed and she has been displaced several times around the city, she and I have been swapping messages and voice notes since the beginning of the conflict. This is the first message she sent me on Saturday, October 14th.
When people ask me where is my biggest fear, I was always answer living in wars. I'm terrified to lose my family, my home, in addition my dreams and my ambitions.
A year ago, she was a high school student, dreaming of becoming an English translator and traveling the world. Now, the sounds of explosions and gunfire have become part of her daily life. She recorded this on her phone when she was hiding in her grandmother's house in Gaza City. Sanabel stayed in touch with me as much as possible in those first few months, but she often wasn't able to access the internet or phone signal. In those times, Sanabel's aunt Ola kept me updated about Sanabel's well-being. This is the last voice message Ola sent on Thursday, November 9th.
Situation very, very, very difficult, very horrible. Sanabel got her grandma, her aunt killed, and her two of children of my family. The situation is very, very, very difficult. I can't speak. I'm so, so sorry.
That was 2 months into the conflict. Sanabel was trying to stay positive in those first few months, focusing on helping her family. Then, in late November, her aunt Ola was killed. Sanabel sent me this message just after.
I can't do anything. I can't do anything, just the word to stop the war. We are really fed up. I can't do anything. Just pray for us, please. I can't. Maybe I'm going to lose my dream, my families. I can't.
Since the start of the war, Gazans have struggled to get enough food and have had extremely limited access to hygiene and sanitation, which led to viruses and other diseases spreading across the strip. Around June, Sanabel and her 16-year-old sister learned that they are among the tens of thousands of Gazans who contracted hepatitis A during the conflict. In their case, it was because of the unclean water they had to drink.
I have a headache and my temperature is too high.
After moving around the first 2 months, Sanabel returned to the partially destroyed family home with her parents and 2 sisters. They all live in 1 room. In July, Israel renewed their offensive in Gaza City, after focusing for some months on the south.
Israel called us to evacuate my area in the middle of Gaza. Like, where can we go? The thing makes me too frightened is see Israeli tanks broke into the street of my home.
Throughout the ordeal, Sanabel has done her best to comfort her little sister, who's only 4 years old.
Dad. To reduce my little sister's fear about the war, we play together, laugh and draw. She always cries she wants apple, and here in Gaza there are no food, vegetables, fruit. So I'm trying to let her forget what she wants.
On Monday, September 16, Sanabel and her family got some small comfort from one of the aid convoys that was able to get into Gaza City.
For the first time after 11 months, finally, we have a chicken. So we really like, I feel like I'm really over the moon. My little sister, finally she will eat in healthy food.
Sanabel and her family are still in Gaza City. Though with constant drones overhead and the constant threat of airstrikes, they want to leave. They have no idea where to go, though. She sent me this clip just over a week ago, on September 25th.
We miss everything. This war ends everything, and our dreams, our ambitions. But we're also trying to find a way to keep living. Sometimes I feel like I give up, but, you know, even if I give up, I have to do something. I have to do something to save my future, to save my life here in Gaza, save my family in Gaza, save our dreams.
A year in Gaza, you heard there from young Palestinian woman Sanabel and from the BBC's Christina Volk, who has been keeping in touch with her over the past 12 months. And it's important to say Israel is not allowing international journalists from media organisations, including the BBC, independent access to Gaza. And a reminder that you can keep up with all developments in the Middle East on our website. Go to the live page, bbc.com/news. There's news of more airstrikes hitting southern Beirut. 3, it would appear, around the area close to the airport. Also, rockets being intercepted in northern Israel coming from Hezbollah, apparently targeting an airbase there as well. That is it, though, for this edition of NewsHour. From me, James Kamara-Sami, and the team, goodbye.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4, Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.